What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. During his campaign for president, Trump called for the deportation of about 4 million people in the United States illegally. He vowed to overturn President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA program, which grants protected status to more than 728,000 young dreamers who were brought to the U.S. illegally as minors. After the election of Donald Trump, many students called for their schools to become sanctuary campuses to protect undocumented students from deportation. Florida State University's student body voted in favor of a referendum to make the school a sanctuary campus. It's estimated that 1.8 million undocumented youth under the age of 18 living in the United States. Approximately 65,000 of these undocumented students graduate from U.S. high schools each year. These are children born abroad who are not U.S. citizens or legal residents. They are guaranteed an education in U.S. public schools. However, undocumented students face legal and financial barriers to higher education. Only 5 to 10% of them continue their higher education. Joining me this hour, I want to say I really appreciate you coming so much. I have 3 undocumented students. Here at the roundtable, I welcome Maria Rodriguez. She is a senior at Florida State. She is majoring in international affairs, and she is active in advocates for immigrant and refugee rights.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
Well, I'm really, again, appreciative so of you coming. Hudson Lana, Florida State University, sophomore, marketing is his thing.
Yes, thank you so much for having us in.
Daniela Donosa, she has already graduated. She graduated in the spring of 2016 in international affairs. Currently, she is the student program coordinator at FSU Center for the Advancement of Human Rights.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And again, I thank you. What does it mean to be an undocumented student? And I'll start with whoever wants to start and hear from all of you.
So, to be undocumented means not to have any sort of legal status in the U.S. So, most undocumented immigrants don't have a social security number, don't have a proper form of identification, and don't have a pathway to citizenship in the U.S.
Okay. And what does it mean?
This makes it a little harder to go on to college just because only a few states allow for in-state tuition for undocumented students. And even though we do have the childhood Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, we are not eligible for any sort of financial aid. We are only allowed to go to school and work, maybe have your driver's license, but tuition must be paid out of pocket or through private scholarships. And like I said, the in-state tuition is only offered in certain states, so it makes life a lot harder.
So on top of the difficulties that come with going to college without any help from the state or from the government, being undocumented also comes with kind of a stigma, and it's something that's not very easy to talk about, and sometimes that can work into like your mentality and your emotions getting through school because, one, you have your parents and your family who wants you to succeed, but you have all these other outside voices saying, oh, you shouldn't be here. Why are you, like taking money or taking opportunities from actual citizens? So being undocumented, even though there have been great steps taken to helping undocumented students, it is still kind of difficult to really get through it.
Would you all share your stories? I mean, because I think people just don't know. They don't have any idea of, what an undocumented student is about, how they got here, what's going on in their lives. And that's why, again, I'm so appreciative of you just coming and sharing this. So would you take some time and just kind of share your particular circumstances as how it evolved, how long you've been here, and on and on?
Of course. This is Maria speaking, yeah. And I am from Colombia. My family and I moved here in early 2000. My mom was the mayor of her city, and my dad was a vet, but also very politically active. Mm-hmm. In Colombia at the time, there were rebel forces called the FARC, which is Armed Forces of Colombia.
Okay.
It's been categorized as a terrorist group. And they were very active at the time. They had a lot of soldiers, a lot of arms, and they were trying to kind of work their way into my mom's city. And my mom just was not going to tolerate that. She tried to talk to her people, talk to her constituents to keep them, like, aware that it's not a good idea to interact with the FARC. And they did not really like that. So they started sending my family death threats. And eventually it escalated to where they shot my mom's bodyguard. And at that point, my parents had three young children. I was 4 years old, and they decided that they were no longer safe there. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't live there with three young children. So my dad being a vet, there was a newspaper ad for somebody in Central Florida who needed a vet for their farm. And my grandpa saw that, talked to my dad, and they thought it was the perfect opportunity. So we talked, or my dad contacted him, and we got our passports, we got our visas, and flew over. And this guy was supposed to, he said that he would take care of, like, the steps for my parents and us to become citizens, mm-hmm. Since he was their employer. And since my parents were pretty desperate to get out to, you know, be safe, they took it, I guess they were too trusting, and they just put all their faith in him. Mm-hmm. And a couple months after being here, it turned out that he sold his farm completely, like, deserted everything without saying another word. And my parents realized that nothing had ever been started. And at that point, we had already fallen out of status, which is we extended our stay. Mm-hmm. So that's where everything began.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Hudson.
Well, for us, we're from a really small town called Pará. It's Rondon do Pará in Pará. It's up northern Brazil. And my parents had been working. My mom was 17 when they got married, and they had been working since then. My dad was an entrepreneur. He's tried starting businesses, but it was a very small town, only 40,000 residents. Oh. So it was really hard, and they're having hard times with finances and everything. And my dad had the chance to come over when I was six. He had the chance to come over to the U.S. through Mexico, and so he did so. And I don't know too much about that story, mm-hmm. but then a year later, my mom came over, and then me and my sister, my older sister, she's 25 now, we stayed with my grandma. And then a year later, they realized they came here just to kind of save up money and go mm-hmm. back to Brazil and start a life, you know, start a business there and everything. But then they easily realized that it's not that quick to raise enough money for that. So mm-hmm. they decided to have us come over as well. So they paid a lot of money to have my sister and I come through the Bahamas illegally, of course. And then my parents had a falling out. And then my dad got deported 2 years after my sister and I arrived. And my dad he had raised a good amount of money, and he had started building a house in Brazil and everything. So we kind of sent everything we had back to Brazil, and we were going to move back. And then my dad told my mom, no, I want you to stay there and send me things to sell and make money mm-hmm. here. And she said, no, I want to go back. Like, I'm tired of this. I don't want to stay here without you. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, if you come back, you don't have anything. So she decided that starting over here from nothing illegally would be better off than going back there and having nothing there. So mm-hmm. That's when that all started. I was in the sixth grade back then. And Since then, we've just been working up from nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so I was born in Ecuador, and I was 6 months old when I came to the U.S. I have two older brothers. Came with my parents on a tourist visa, and at the time had an uncle that was already a U.S. citizen, my dad's brother, and they started a petition for us. And a family petition can take a very long time. And
what does that involve, if you don't mind, the family petition?
Sure. So for a family, for a sibling to petition for their other sibling, mm-hmm. There's a waiting list that can take more than 20 years.
Oh.
Right.
What?
So
you're kidding me.
No. It takes a very long time. If you are... a wife, or if you are if you're a spouse, or if you are a mother or father or a child, you know, that wait list gets a little smaller. But for siblings, there's no expedited process mm-hmm. for that. And so we were waiting on that petition, which was approved in 2004, so it did take about 10 years. But by that time, the last part of that process is getting your passport stamped in your country consulate. And so what happened was that sort of like Maria, with our attorney and things, we fell out of status, not really understanding the mm-hmm. immigration process, because immigrants come here, you know, there's a language barrier. You don't know exactly what the process is. You come under false pretenses. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was we were already out of status at that point. So what happens when you are out of status for more than a year is you get a 10-year ban. So if you leave the United States when you're out of status, you can't come back for 10 years. Yes. So that's sort of a punishment that they have. And so what happened was our last step, even though we were approved, was to get our passport stamped in Ecuador. So the decision was, do we go back and then have this risk of not coming back for 10 years, or what do we do? And by that point in 2004, you know, I was in fourth grade. My brothers were in really great magnet schools or really great, you know, high schools. And so
sounds like you had kind of acclimated to the.
Of course. Right. You know, me coming here as a baby, you know, obviously I know English better now than I do Spanish, even though I speak that fluently.
Let me interrupt you for just a second.
Absolutely.
We need to take a brief break, but I'll start back with you. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. This hour, I'm talking with undocumented students. Daniela, I had to stop you, but if you would continue, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. So, so definitely acclimated. You know, when I was 13 is when I found out that I was undocumented.
And how did that happen?
So it happened because my older brothers were getting ready to apply to college. And, of course, my parents, never having gone through that process here in the U.S., they didn't know what they would need if they could apply without a Social Security number. And so they sat us down and they had a serious conversation with us and told us, hey, you know, we're not citizens. You know, and obviously our family from Ecuador were very privileged to say could come and visit us in the U.S. And so that was always great. But I knew somehow that I wasn't able, and I thought it was because we didn't have enough money to travel outside of the U.S. And so they sat us down and they talked about how, you know, moving back to Ecuador could be a very, you know, serious, serious thing for us. And at the age of 13, you know, with my friend group and everything that I knew, I was angry and I didn't understand at that age what was going on. But, you know, we were, you know, blessed in my brothers getting into really great colleges with scholarships, and so again, my parents decided to stay, and it wasn't until my senior year of high school that well, when I was a junior in high school, my dad's father passed away in Ecuador. And obviously there was no way for us to go back to Ecuador for the funeral or anything like that, you know, or for weddings or for babies or for celebrations. Right. For
so anything. You haven't seen your family. Well, I guess they can come to visit you.
Yeah, they can come to visit, you know, as family members get older, grandparents mm-hmm. and things, it's harder for them to travel. And so my senior year, my mom's father got very sick, and she has a medical degree. She's from Ecuador, and at the time was working in a telemarketer office in Jacksonville. And you know, she just looked at me and she told me, you know, I'm not a criminal. I haven't done anything wrong. Why do they call me a criminal? And I should be the one taking care of my father in Ecuador, not some random nurses that don't know him, not his family. And so we considered again, and because I was applying to colleges as an international student, because I didn't have a social security number, and DACA was not granted at the time, that's what you have to do if you don't have a social security number. You apply to college as an international student. Okay. So that's how I applied to Florida State. And but before that process was happening, this was in the spring of 2012, and so we were considering again moving back to Ecuador. I was, you know, again, really angry, but mm-hmm. I was ready, because to me, you know, the U.S. didn't have to be the whole world. But that same summer of 2012 is when Obama came out with deferred action for childhood arrivals. And our attorney told us, you know, you need to stay. You guys qualify for this. This could be really great relief for you guys. So that's what we decided to do.
How does being undocumented at this point influence your lives, your everyday lives, as far as what you do, or do you not feel undocumented? I mean, do you feel undocumented?
Yes.
Okay, explain to me how. I mean, I just, you know, my questions may be ignorant, but I don't know.
No, absolutely. You know, I think right now, feeling like what Maria was talking about with DACA and having sort of, you know, it's a Band-Aid right mm-hmm. now, right? So we sort of have a status, but not really. We have to renew it every 2 years. That's what DACA is. Yeah. You get a work permit. Right. You can get a social security number. You can have a license. You know, you can apply for things that you've never been able to before.
But you're still...
So there's sort of a source of empowerment from that. But mm-hmm. you're still, I mean, and maybe for all of us, our parents are still undocumented, right? So there's still, you know, when we talk on the phone, oh, yeah, you have to drive to work. Oh, yeah, you can be stopped by the police at any moment. You know, there's still that sense of worry. Oh, yeah, you have to go sell hammocks at a flea market because you can't get a real, you know, stable job right now, mm-hmm. you know, or thinking about how you're going to pay for graduate school or what is next. Or, you know, my brother has an art show exhibit in New York City, and my parents of course want to go, but there's always that risk of traveling, even domestically.
Really? So domestic travel is a big issue.
Just stepping into an airport is an issue for anyone that's undocumented. It's really scary, honestly. My mom has experienced that recently. She one of her friends kind of treated her. She doesn't really travel, but her friend treated her with a trip, and she was scared out of her mind to go into the airport.
Oh, okay. So you're looming. You're vulnerable, is what I hear you all say.
Right. Yeah. I guess my take on your question is, yes, I always do feel undocumented, and it's kind of something that's always in the back of your head. You know, you don't go through your usual day just, like, being gloomy about it, but there's always the thought, like Daniela said, like your parents could be stopped at any moment if they, like my parents are fortunate enough to have driver's licenses, but once their permit expires, and if they haven't had enough time to get the new one, they might be driving without a license for a certain amount of time, and it's really scary that they could be stopped and like immediately start being deported, like start the process to be deported. That's always very scary. And I'm studying French and Arabic, and one thing that I always wanted to do was be able to go to France. And whenever I was a junior in high school, you know, you're looking to see where you're going to go to college. I made sure to make my list with schools that had good study abroad programs because I knew that I wanted to travel. And I knew that I couldn't travel at that very moment, but I was hopeful that, you know, as my senior year came to a close and as I was in college, that something would change and that the opportunity would be, like, real and that I could go abroad. But unfortunately, nothing ever changes. You're still undocumented. You still can't travel. And I never had that opportunity to go. And it's that I think that's been my hardest. Like, the thing that's hit me the hardest is not being able to leave the U.S. Because of the study abroad. And in elementary school, I was one of the only two people in our elementary school chosen to do a program called People to People, which are educational tours. And 1 year, I was going to be able to go to Europe and see, like, the ruins and everything. And another year, I would have been able to go to Australia. And those are things that, you know, I really wanted to do. My parents were like, yes, do the packets, study, do whatever they ask you to do. And at the moment, we were mostly worried about the finance of it. They said that they would figure out the money. And, you know, we just – you're always hopeful that you're going to have your documents in order by the time you actually have to do whatever you want to do. But again, it's always like – opportunity after opportunity, you're just hopeful and then it gets crushed. So I think that was the hardest thing for me personally.
Now, you're a senior.
Yes, ma'am.
And what are you going to do once you finish?
Once I finish, I am going to take at least a year in between graduating and maybe going on to a different degree because I'm not sure if I want to go to law school or go to a grad school. I, because of our, you know, background in as immigrants, I've seen how difficult the immigration process is. I've seen how broken it is, how people are left with no hope and just it's really difficult to even get good legal assistance. So that has really driven me to want to be that good legal assistance for other people. And that's something that I've just recently kind of really thought I would actually do because I've thought about it before but thought that maybe I was too invested. But that's definitely an option now. And the other thing that I'm kind of on edge about is whether I want to do that or do a master's in social work or public administration to just work in NGOs, you know, giving aid in a different sort of manner.
How have all of you navigated higher education? I mean, and when I say that, I mean just about every aspect of it, from the financial component, you know, to registering for classes. How have you been able to accomplish that?
For the finances, for me, I started sophomore year of high school. That was when I kind of realized that I could go to college because of deferred action and everything like that. I finally saw that there was hope for me to go to college, and I knew I had good grades and everything. So that's when I got my first job, and I started saving up. And my whole thing was that if I get enough money for the first year, then I'll be able to get enough money for the second year and, like, so on and so forth. So, yeah, in high school, I was able to save enough money for the first year of college. And then during the first year, I saved enough for the second year. And always working during the summer, doing two, three jobs, always saving up money, always giving up opportunities because I have to put that money aside. And then, yeah, now I'm kind of still hopeful that I'll be able to graduate, but like I don't have the money for the next 2 years. So right now I have the money for next year, and next year I'll have the money for the next.
Okay.
Yeah. So even though my brothers had been through the process before, everything was very new to me, having to apply as an international student and things like that. So my senior year, you know, my guidance counselor hadn't really gone through this either. And so we were kind of helping each other out. She understood finally after that I didn't have a social security number. I couldn't do things that people with a social security number could do, like apply for Bright Futures, even though I qualify for it.
You don't even think about it. I mean, as you all say these things, it's like, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, I qualified 100%, had all these, you know, took all these AP classes and, you know, with my colleagues. And I felt sort of this despair of, okay, I've done everything I thought that I should have, you know, taken the academics. I'm a strong candidate. I should be able to do this. So once we got past, you know, no social security number, then we started looking into local community scholarships. And that's how I paid, at least for my first year of college, was just applying to everything. So I spent a lot of senior year going on appointments, doing interviews, and trying to find a way to fund college. And so after I got rejection after rejection from a lot of schools that I applied to, that was around the same time that my parents were talking about going back to Ecuador. And, you know, at that point, I was fine with it because I was so frustrated with the entire system. And so, but, you know, my guidance counselor actually is the one that did encourage me to apply to Florida State University. And I'm so glad that she did. And so at Florida State, they have something, this was before DACA, called residency for tuition purposes. And many public institutions do have it. So you prove that you're a resident of the state just for tuition purposes, right? And so I was able to show, you know, basically through my K-12 transcripts, hey, you know, I've been here. Exactly. You know, and which that's not the case with every person. That's a very case-by-case sort of thing. And so, but, you know, the people that I spoke with at FSU, everything that happened, I was admitted as an in-state, even though I was still considered an international student.
So as I understand, just to interrupt you a little bit, as I understand it, every institution has their own policies on admission of undocumented students.
So as of at least Florida now, so talking about Florida, in 2014, we passed a law to allow undocumented students to pay in-state tuition.
And that's right.
Yeah. So before that, that was not the case. Not the case. And I, you know, I was also part of Advocates for Immigrant Refugee Rights at Florida State, and we had various members of that organization who were taking only a couple classes at a time paying out-of-state tuition because of their immigration status. So again, very case by case, you know, under the discretion of whoever was looking at, you know, your information. And so it was difficult, I think a huge problem that we have is access to information. Even after DACA has come out, you know, there's a lot of students whose parents, you know, might not know anything about college applications, have never finished high school. And so how do you expect them to know how to navigate through a college application and them, you know, not really understanding their immigration status, how to fill it out, things like that? So that's, I think, a huge problem right now for students still to navigate. But I was, you know, lucky enough to have my guidance counselor support, even though she didn't really understand a lot either. But
she was supportive and willing to try to find out as much as she possibly could.
Yeah. And my brothers and I, we were all RAs where we lived. So that really helped offset the costs during the rest of college.
What's the next step in each one of your process? I mean, are you pursuing citizenship? I mean, where are you?
I wish.
So unfortunately, right now, there's nothing as well, for my case, for my family's case, there's nothing that we can do. There has been nothing that we can do on our part for a couple of years now. As soon as, like, my parents found out that we had fallen out of status, they started taking it upon themselves to try to apply to be residents and, you know, just have some legal standing here. But finding, like I said, finding good lawyers at that time was very difficult. So there was a period in time when it was just kind of a trial and error. Eventually, we did find a good lawyer and apply for residency. But because we had fallen out of status for a couple of months, I think, we were denied our residency. And we appealed that, and it was denied again. So with our case right now, my siblings and I have DACA have deferred action for childhood arrivals, but my parents, they are just under a closed case, like administrative closure. With that, you can't really go backwards and you can't go forwards. It's just a waiting game.
What can you do?
You have some sort of legal status. So my parents have a social security number and a work permit. But you can't, there's no road, there's no path to continue to try to become citizens again or anything like that. I think there's like a sort of band-aid on being deported, but that's kind of discretionary also. And it's just up to the legislation. It's just some reform has to be passed. There's nothing that we can do about it. It's just limbo and it's just waiting and nothing that we can control, which is really difficult because imagine living your life with no power as to what your future looks like.
I'm just thinking you're getting ready to graduate.
Right. Yeah.
Will you be able to secure a job?
I will be, thanks to the Deferred Action for Children Arrivals.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I do have a work permit, so I am allowed to work. And like Daniela said, we have to apply for that every 2 years. So I just renewed mine, and every renewal costs about $500. And yeah, imagine doing that for like three students, right? Yes, ma'am. So it is a nice band-aid because you are allowed to do some of the things that you couldn't do before, but it's like everything else in immigration, it's extremely expensive and it's a band-aid. There's nothing, nowhere to go with it.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I tell you, this is a real education for me. And I can't say again how much I appreciate you coming. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. What's the 411? The undocumented student population comes from all over the world. A majority come from Mexico and other Central America countries, with approximately 6.7 million from Mexico. The second largest area is Asia. DACA is not a law. It's a presidential executive authority, which means it can change based on the president. It can be terminated or not renewed based on the discretion of DHS, Department of Homeland Security. It opens up the space to qualify, I guess is the best way to say it, for post-secondary education. I mean, you said you're allowed to have a Social Security, you're allowed to work, but you're still extremely limited.
Correct.
So I got that right. Another question I wanted to ask you, and you mentioned about legal help, and I don't know how good, but I wanted to ask you, are you familiar with the National Immigration Law Center?
Sure.
Okay. Are they helpful? I mean, because I wasn't, you know, I read it and it seemed like, yes, they give their first consultation is free, but then the rest of it you have to pay for? Is that how it works?
I'm not completely sure. I don't know if it's a case-by-case basis or if they have pro bono attorneys, you know, that would take, you know, specific cases if they're refugees or asylum seekers. I know that, you know, here in Tallahassee, we have the Center for Advancement of Human Rights, which is considered Department of Florida State University, but one of our missions is to serve our community. And so we work as a pro bono immigration office. So we do serve DACA students, and we do serve asylum seekers and refugees. And I can tell you that resources are very scarce, and they're very limited, even for DACA students. To be able, you know, if an attorney wants to charge you $500 a consultation, you very much want to take the precaution of because of horror stories, you know, of falling out of status and not knowing, you know, your next step. You know, we definitely recommend seeing an attorney. And so,
right.
But those pro bono attorneys are, you know, hard to find.
And even like you should see a lawyer, but that's very difficult also for some families, because a lot of times these families are working jobs that don't pay great. You know, even if they have a college degree from their home country, they're working basic jobs,
mm-hmm.
Minimal wage jobs maybe. And a lot of times lawyers are very expensive.
Yeah.
I know that in the past 17 years, which we have been going through this process, my parents have spent tens of thousands, maybe near $100,000 in just the process, like the applications and attorney's fees. So it's incredibly expensive and incredibly difficult for these people to afford it and to be able to, you know, say, well, we need to do this process, so we'll allocate this money that we could have used for more food or, you know, mm-hmm. more things mm-hmm. to do this because it's more important. But sometimes you don't have that leeway.
It is still rough, but I have noticed recently with the new administration and everything, the communities have been kind of helping each other. And I know in South Florida there's a big Brazilian community, mm-hmm. and I've been noticing a lot of the lawyers, Brazilian lawyers in South Florida, making videos, going live on Facebook, giving information. They're not doing pro bono work because they can't really afford to do right. that themselves. I mean, they've paid a lot of money to have those degrees here,
right.
And most of them were international students. You know, they went through the same things we did, so they can't really afford to do that. But they are getting that information out there. They are answering people's questions. They are making sure that you're not wasting your money if there's nothing you can do.
Okay.
Like, if my mother walked into a lawyer, a Brazilian lawyer in South Florida, they would tell her, there's nothing you can do. Don't give me any money because
you're just losing your money. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good.
So that has been good, but it's still rough. And if there is a pathway for you, then you do still have to go and pay those fees and the immigration fees and the lawyer fees and everything like that.
Yeah, but also with just this great vulnerability of the new administration and, you know, the risks that people are taking now, it's just such a hub for people to take advantage of others.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's so frustrating and infuriating because people, you know, notaries are saying, hey, I'll help you with your immigration case, because people are so desperate right now. They're so desperate to not be undocumented because they're so terrified of ICE coming into their community and saying, mm-hmm. you know, show me your papers. I'm going to put you in deportation proceedings. You know, when you are just working and want to have a better life for your family.
Are you familiar with this happening in various communities?
In our own community, here in North Florida, of course. Yeah, yeah. Across the country, this was one of the huge reasons why the day after the election, there was the sanctuary movement,
mm-hmm.
right, on college campuses, which was so amazing to see, you know, how much people wanted to gather and mobilize to protect their immigrant communities. And, you know, this also includes their Muslim communities
right.
and,
right.
you know, anybody who's feeling at risk right now under the new administration. And so, you know, we just saw even our own office getting calls from our own community, you know, in Quincy here around North Florida saying, you know, I'm scared. What am I supposed to do? So I think a lot of advocacy organizations, like Hudson was saying, you know, are focusing on getting information out there on for people to know what their rights are. That's, I think, the greatest tool that you can have as an undocumented immigrant is knowing that you still have rights in this country. Even if you don't have all the opportunities, you do have those rights.
Where can undocumented students, families go here that are in North Florida, right here in this town? What resources are available for them to, you know,
yeah.
take advantage of that you would share with us?
Sure. Well, you have two great resources sitting at this table. One is the Center for Advancement of Human Rights. We do work, again, as a pro bono immigration office. You know, we have an immigration attorney.
Where are you?
He's a director.
Where are you located? Give us the whole spiel.
Okay. So this is Florida State University Center for the Advancement of Human Rights, located on 426 West Jefferson Street. We do serve immigrant victims of crime pro bono. We do serve DACA students as well pro bono. You know, sometimes it is a case-by-case basis, so nothing's guaranteed. But that is a service. And if anyone is also interested in a Know Your Rights presentation or needs just some basic information about their own rights, we do have bilingual, you know, Spanish speakers in the office that can also help. So that's one resource for them. And then, you know, on campus, we have other resources and student groups even that mobilize to do outreaches to the community. So if you are part of a church and you think okay. that your congregation could really benefit from something like a Know Your Rights presentation, whether it's in English and Spanish, if you need it in another language, let us know. We want to be a resource for those people and for those immigrants. And we also serve victims of human trafficking, you know, which is a whole nother discussion. No, we won't really get into, but, you know, these vulnerabilities of being undocumented, of, you know, language barriers, of very low wages, of not knowing or understanding what your rights are. Mm-hmm. So being, you know, abused and thinking that it's okay. There are also resources out there for you.
Right. And if you can't travel, if you can't take off time to come to the center, you can always go on Google and look up the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, mm-hmm. or United We Dream, and they have great little infographics on the rights that you have and just different sorts of little things that might help you if you can't travel.
I think you've answered this, or at least alluded to it indirectly, but what impact has the Trump presidency had on undocumented families? You know, a couple have already been deported.
Right.
That were, one of them I know was a student, okay, and had his DACA and everything, mm-hmm. but he still was deported. And Trump said that he really was just concerned about those who were criminals or whatever. Of course, Attorney General Sessions said, if you're undocumented, you're here illegally, and you're all susceptible.
So the night of the election, I remember watching it, and I remember just even as everything started coming to a close and it seemed that Donald Trump was going to be elected president, I remember there was still like the smallest glimmer of hope that that wouldn't be the case, because I knew that that would make everybody's life so much more difficult and you would just live in fear and everything. But the day after, you know, it was official, he had been elected, I talked to my parents and my mom, like they were still scared and everything. We were crying, but she was like, we're just going to continue doing everything that we've always done. We're going to continue to do everything correctly. We're going to make clean money. We're going to be hopeful and believe in God, and it's going to be okay. We're going to, you know, make it through it.
It's got to be a mom thing, because my mom said the same.
They all say the same
exact thing. She's like, don't cry. Don't you be crying right now. We're going to be fine.
Yeah. But with everything how it's been working out, at least for DACA, it doesn't seem to be that it's going to be taken away, at least right now. And that had been like a position that Donald Trump had taken. But there's still a lot of fear. There mm-hmm. are a lot. It's crazy to me that you have to kind of scapegoat a whole group of people. You know, you have to kind of criminalize somebody. And it's not okay to just generally say that any undocumented immigrant is a threat, because that's not true. There is so much money, so much like amazing things that undocumented communities bring to the mm-hmm. table.
Indeed.
And a lot of times people say, oh, well, they're taking our jobs, they're not paying taxes, they're, you know, on like welfare,
that's
things
ridiculous.
Like that. And that's just
not true.
You can't, as an undocumented person, you can't take, you're not eligible to have
yeah.
programs like welfare or
right.
scholarships that are federally funded. So,
I'm so
it's
glad
not true.
You mentioned that.
And,
yeah.
you know, everybody has at least a tax identification number, even mm-hmm. if they're not citizens or have mm-hmm. any status, the IRS knows you're here and they want your money. So you are always contributing to, you know, taxes, but you're just not reaping all the benefits from it, like social programs other than like roads and things like that.
Personally, for your question, the day after the inauguration, I decided I wasn't going to believe anything that came out of his mouth. So I know he recently talked about how he likes the Dreamers and he wouldn't do anything to the Dreamers. I don't believe any of that. Mm-hmm. So the day after the inauguration, mm-hmm. the first thing I did was go to my advisor and make a plan for me to graduate before my DACA expires. Because it expires, I'm supposed to graduate spring of 2019, but my DACA expires September of 2018. So I'm currently taking 18 credit hours and plan to do so for the next couple of semesters, taking extra classes over the summer, and just trying to graduate before that September 2018 date. Because if anything, I'll have a degree.
At least you'll have that.
Yeah, so it's just kind of playing by ear and just trying to get, you know, as much done as possible while you can and hope that you'll be able to renew and continue to fight.
Yeah. Again, just it's been mostly the impact of fear. You know, even though Trump has said these things of, mm-hmm. you know, I want to focus on the criminals, he has still instilled this fear in communities, but also has instilled just this sense of empowerment to even people who want to be racist, you know, and Islamophobic and all of the rest, but that they just feel like with the case of the Dreamer, you know, under the discretion of a Border Patrol agent, you know, mm-hmm. who decides, no, you know what, you're not a citizen, I don't want you in my country, you're going to be deported, you know, and look what's happened, and he's still in Mexico, right?
Right.
So that's why I think, you know, again, with the airports, it's even scary just to step in because you don't know what one officer wants to decide to do. You know, there was a case with a mother who was DACA, and she left the country for humanitarian reasons, and which you're allowed to do if you are granted parole by the government.
Okay.
And so she came back, and a Border Patrol agent told her, you know what, actually, DACA doesn't exist anymore, and you can't come in here. You know, and that's the discretion of a border agent. So it's not only like this sense of fear, but also this sense
of... So there are no real standards that they have to follow.
No real standards. I mean, completely under the discretion of custom border agents, you know. There is, you know, a group, another umbrella under Department of Homeland Security because mm-hmm. ICE is under this. United States Immigration Services is under this umbrella. They also have this sort of civil liberties group that, you know, is a check and balances for Department of Homeland Security mm-hmm. even here mm-hmm. in the States. So, I mean, that could be another great resource. But, again, how do people just know that these things
exist?
They don't
know.
Right? It's
yeah.
just the access of information. It's hard. So I think this Trump administration and era, is definitely it's not only that it makes people fearful of their future, but it's also that we don't see a clear future, right? Under, you know, we were hoping for, we don't hope for DACA to continue forever,
right?
And there's
right.
lawmakers out there that are starting something called a Bridge Act, mm-hmm. which would make DACA a law, right? And that's great, and it's a provisional act, but that's not what I want.
That's not right.
You know, and
that's
and I want
answer.
A pathway to citizenship.
Right.
That's what I want. I want comprehensive immigration reform, and that's not going to happen in a House and a Senate that is taken over by Republicans. It's just not. And so I think that's difficult for mm-hmm. people to just have to come to terms with, you are where you are right now. That's where you're at, you know. And of course, you know, if you marry a U.S. citizen, like that's an option for you. But who's just out there,
just,
you know,
yeah,
thinking, hey,
I am.
Right? So, you know, the government shouldn't be able to dictate when you think you should be married mm-hmm. or when you think that you should graduate college,
mm-hmm.
you know. So again, and again, I think that we have a lot of privilege, us that are sitting here, even
right.
as DACA-mented students,
mm-hmm.
Because we have DACA, and we've talked about the price of having to pay and how even being able to afford that for you and maybe if you have siblings is a privilege. So I understand that, but there's still a lot of room that we want to move forward in.
Right. And we have maybe 30 seconds, but any words of wisdom that you might share with younger undocumented students?
I would say if you want to go on to higher education or if you are trying to find a job, contact somebody who knows, contact the center, look up the ACLU, just get help because there are options and really just stay hopeful and continue upholding the traditions and the values that the American people and we have because we share into that.
Well, again, I can't say how much I appreciate you come and sharing, you know, your experiences and your stories. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.